You're listening to WBTV-LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. On Saturday, the 23rd, this coming Saturday, the Vermont College of Fine Arts will present the third annual Vermont Book Award to a Vermont poet or author of prose, and the award was established in 2014. It is a literary prize administered by Vermont College of Fine Arts that honors work of outstanding literary merit by Vermont authors and celebrates the long tradition of literature in the state. So in reading about the upcoming ceremony and then reading back about the last 2 years, nominees and judges and winner, I came to realize that I had actually interviewed a great many of the people who are involved with this award in one way or another. So during our talk, when we were first broadcasting, I did a show in which I simply dropped the needle, as I put it, and obviously we're not using records and needles, but so to speak, I dropped the needle inside of several of those interviews, playing just little snippets of conversation with these authors and poets, wonderful Vermont authors and poets. A number of people later got in touch to say that they had enjoyed the show and they wished that they could share it with friends who hadn't heard it by way of the podcast site. And it wasn't recorded. I didn't record it. So I thought it would be fun to do it again. So we're going to get started here. First up, I'm going to play an excerpt with from an interview with the Vermont author Gary Lee Miller. Now, Gary Lee Miller actually was a co-host with me on this show for a brief period of time, a couple of years, and that was fun too. And I'll just read you a little bit about Gary. He's the creative director of Writers for Recovery, a series of writers' workshops helping people overcome addiction. And his fiction has been published in a number of national literary magazines. And then he had a short story collection, Museum of the Americas, which was published in 2014 by Burlington's Fomite Press, a wonderful indie publisher right here. So that's a little bit of information. I'm not going to give you a lot about each of these people because we've got a number to go through. Gary Lee Miller's short story collection, Museum of the Americas, was nominated for the very first Vermont Book Award, and he made it onto the shortlist. I'm going to just play a little tiny bit of an interview with Gary, and we're just going to hop right into the middle of the interview and see what we come up with. So I hope that you enjoy this part of an interview with Gary Lee Miller.
But I think really at his heart, he does feel that pain over you know, the way his brother's made.
Yeah.
That's different from him.
Right. It's also refreshing when there's a narrator. You know, and naturally, we mostly take the side of narrators in stories, I think. And when he's flawed a little bit, and I do think that this is a little bit of a character flaw, that he's not capable of helping his brother more. That's more interesting. That's so much more interesting to me than characters that are just black and white.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's about dimensionality, I guess. And I don't even know if I'm consciously going, I need to create a character with multiple dimensions, or whether it's just more interesting to me to try to create someone that has a flaw. I mean, to me, if everything's going well in a story, that's the sign that your reader's going to get bored.
Right.
And trouble makes interest.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
So.
I have to apologize next time I see Gary for having cut him off quite so abruptly. But I am just really playing a little snippet from each of these interviews. And you might hear from him again later, because when he did the show with me, he interviewed another one of these folks. So you'll hear from him again. I'm next going to play a little bit of an interview with Jessica Hendry Nelson from 2014. Jessica Hendry Nelson is the author of the memoir and essays If Only You People Could Follow Directions, which was published by Counterpoint Press. And it was selected as a best debut book by the Indies Introduce New Voices program, the Indies Next List by the American Booksellers Association, named a best book of the year by Kirkus Review. It received starred reviews in Kirkus and Publishers Weekly. It was reviewed nationally in print and on NPR, and it was included twice in Oprah magazine, and it was a finalist for the very first Vermont Book Award. In addition, Jessica Hendry Nelson was a judge for the 2016 Vermont Book Award. So we're going to just jump into a conversation that I had with Jessica in 2014.
Sort of the turning point for these fights. You know, he's actually going to be able to fight back at this point. And you relay this in the essay, and then you transition into a scene from another day where you and your brother went into Philadelphia to see an art exhibit. And it's really a dance exhibit where ballet dancers are fitted with mics, and you are able to hear their exertion as they are dancing. And you were very struck by this, and just sort of what it is to exert energy. And you say, this is a quote, "It was maybe the first time I realized how two opposing truths could exist at the same time, beauty and pain, light and dark, love and hate." And then you briefly bring in the physicality of your father passed out on the floor in another room, you know, when he was using drugs or alcohol. The weave of these moments is so beautiful, and the transitions between these scenes and your realization, and also sort of an underlying truth about beauty and pain and how much that relates in this book. So I wonder if you remember writing those scenes and putting them together in this way, and if we could talk a little bit about transition and your approach to transition.
Sure. Transition is something that I struggled with for a long time in my writing. And my way of dealing with it for a long time was to just not do them, just not write transitions at all. And that sort of worked for me in that, you know, as I developed as a writer, they became less non-transitions, but they, you know, they have logic. But I don't like to do the hand-holding through transition. Mm-hmm. So I'd rather let the moments and let the juxtaposition do the work of the transition rather than having to spell it out. So, and with the transitions that you mentioned, that's interesting because I do remember being very conscious writing that piece and thinking about that moment when we had fought, how little was actually said and how much was just in our breathing and gesture and the physicality of it, really the physicality.
Right.
And how in families, you know, so much of your communication is a physical abutment, you know, whether it's tenderness or violence. And certainly with my brother and me, you know, we were together so much growing up, whether we liked it or not, that, you know, we were colliding all the time. So in good and bad ways, you know.
This is WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org and broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. And this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm doing a different sort of thing in this hour where I'm just playing excerpts of previous interviews with various poets and authors that have something to do with the Vermont Book Award, which is going to take place. The third annual Vermont Book Award takes place this Saturday. So the next interview that I'm going to feature is with the author Meg Wolitzer, who I spoke with in 2014 about her novel Bell Jar, which was published by Dutton. Meg Wolitzer was nominated for the Vermont Book Award in 2015. She's not a Vermont resident, but the book Bell Jar has Vermont as one of its settings. Originally, the Vermont Book Award did nominate people who had books that had something to do with Vermont, not just Vermont authors. I'm not quite sure if that's still the case. But anyway, so here's a little information about Meg Wolitzer. Her novels include The Interestings, The Uncoupling, The 10-Year Nap, The Position, and The Wife. She's also the author of a novel for middle grade readers, The Fingertips of Duncan Dorfman, and a novel for young adults, Bell Jar, which I already mentioned. Her short fiction has appeared in The Best American Short Stories and the Pushcart Prize. She's a faculty member of the MFA program at Stony Brook, Southampton. In September 2013, along with singer-songwriter Susie Roche, she was a guest artist in the Princeton Atelier program at Princeton University. You know, I didn't know how to say that even when I first interviewed her. I really need to figure that out next time I excerpt one this interview. Anyway, okay. Meg Wolitzer, I spoke to her in November of 2014, and I am now going to just play just a little snippet from that interview. Topics class, telling his or her story. So can you talk about working in that way, and was that fun?
Yeah, it's very enjoyable to be able to kind of move from one person to another. And it's a little tricky, you know, for people who are writing students and they're always sort of asking about questions about first person versus third person. And, you know, there are ways around the limitations of one versus another. And mm-hmm. I think here, while the book is in first person and I wanted to do it in first person, I had to think of a way that we could hear these other stories too. So I just sort of let them talk, and I enjoyed being able to do that. You know, it involved like a lot of paragraphs that begin with quote marks, which I'm very unused to doing. Mm-hmm. But just let them tell their stories. Just let them talk. It was kind of liberating.
And again, just so what would happen, you know, I mean, this group of kids, first they meet in class, but they also meet secretly, privately, apart from class. And that seems just like that's what would happen. They would get together and talk and tell each other their stories.
I mean, it's kind of a fantasy, the idea that, first of all, you're away from your parents, but second of all, you can sort of go off secretly to the classroom at night with a candle and tell each other things you couldn't tell anybody else. I mean, that, to me, stands for that kind of privacy and intimacy of first revelations that I think people need when they're that age. Mm-hmm.
That, again, was an excerpt from an interview with Meg Wolitzer. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I should also mention that all of these interviews that you're hearing little bits of, if you want to hear the full interview, they are all archived on the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. And if you go there and you click on the three horizontal lines up next to the name of the show, you'll be able to search for the names of any of these authors you'd like to look for, or you can have a look at the alphabetized list of all the authors I've spoken to in the last 9 years doing this show for a couple different radio stations, first The Radiator, and then I was just podcasting on my own for a while, and now with WBTV, very happily. So the next excerpt is with Howard Frank Mosher, and actually I played a full interview with him not too long ago, but we'll just do a little excerpt. Howard Frank Mosher was the author of 11 novels and 2 travel memoirs. He was born in the Catskill Mountains in 1942. He lived in Vermont's fabled Northeast Kingdom since 1964. He won many, many awards for his fiction, and he is remembered so fondly as a real icon of Vermont literature. And he passed away very sadly. He passed away at the age of 74, I believe, in the early part of 2017. He was one of the judges for the 2015 Vermont Book Award, the first Vermont Book Award. And so I spoke with Howard in 2010, and I'm just going to play a little bit of that interview for you. We're just jumping in right in the middle, and we'll see what we were talking about at minute 32. Here you go.
Now, at that point, you would have been working on the book 5 or 6 years already.
So that's right.
How did you have the emotional distance to be able to see which parts weren't working?
Well, I had a very good editor.
Okay.
And actually, I have always found it much easier to cut than to add to a book. Once it reaches a certain point, to add to it requires just gearing up and somehow or other getting to the point where I can pour a whole lot of additional emotion that I probably don't have at that stage of the work into the book again. Whereas cutting is more of an analytical process, and once you've decided where the book needs to be cut and how to do it strategically, you can often gain emotional impact by cutting. I've always thought that some of my favorite short stories, particularly Hemingway's and Flannery O'Connor's, have a lot of emotional impact that would be very difficult to sustain in a novel over 300 pages, but you can sometimes achieve in 10 or 15 pages, much the way you can in a poem. I'm not a poet, but I admire short stories and poems. So cutting is not usually difficult for me, but as my editor kept reminding me, you have to be careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater, you know, if there's something, and she would say, take a razor blade to it and do some cutting around the edges and then go back and do some more, but don't go at it, you know, with an axe. That's not the way to proceed. That was good advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned Flannery O'Connor, and it just made me smile, because there were two authors that
came to mind while I was reading this book, and I think it had a lot to do with your character names and nicknames. And I thought about Flannery O'Connor. I thought about the misfit in A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And then I was thinking, too, of Annie Prue. Mm-hmm. And you do a wonderful job finding just the perfect character names. And your antagonists all had these fabulous nicknames, like the doctor surgeon. And so I was curious if Flannery O'Connor is at all an influence for you or anything.
But, yeah, she's a huge influence. Now, I have to say that I don't entirely share what I judge to be her vision. If there's a way to do the wrong thing instead of the right thing, and to do it for the wrong reason, her characters will find that. Now, that's meant to be funny. It is funny. I find her wildly hilarious, but I think she's also, I think that's part of her theology and part of her philosophy.
All right, that again was a little piece of an interview that I did with Howard Frank Mosher in 2010, and he was a judge for the first Vermont Book Award. Another judge that year was the poet Major Jackson, who actually then went on to win the 2016 Vermont Book Award. I spoke to Major Jackson earlier this year in February when we were first starting to stream, you know, broadcast here through the stream. We weren't broadcasting on the radio yet, but Major was my first interview at WBTV, and I really enjoyed talking to him. In this interview, we do a lot of reading of his poems. We're going to jump in, and then if it turns out that he's reading one of his poems in the area that I jump into, I might just fade it and find a spot where he's talking about his craft. So let me tell you a little bit about Major Jackson. He is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, among other honors. He teaches at UVM and is the poetry editor of the Harvard Review. His first book, Leaving Saturn, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and each of his last two collections, Hoops and Holding Company, was a finalist for the NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literature and Poetry. He lives in South Burlington, and he was the winner of the Vermont Book Award with his most recent book, which was a poetry collection called Roll Deep, published by Norton. So, here we go. I'm going to play a little bit of my interview from earlier this year with Major Jackson.
The center of language such that the poem makes a music, even if it's in free verse. So I want to borrow, by teaching myself how to write rhyming, metered poems, I wanted to have that as part of my DNA when I went to go write free verse poems. So it is something that, particularly with this sequence, that I've continued to do even after all these years.
Yeah, and then we'll get there, but there are some other poems toward the back of the collection that are doing other things in imitation of another sort of form or another. So we'll talk about that later. But
yeah.
Do you do that? Do you set yourself a lot of sort of playful exercises or tasks?
Yeah, it's a way for me to kind of jump into the poem when nothing is kind of urgent or pressing.
Yeah.
It's just a way to kind of start a poem and hopefully, you know, write my way into some subject matter or theme that's going to kind of hopefully be at the core rather than calling attention to the structure.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I do think that although I would not categorize myself as a formal poet, I do use rhyme and meter as one of many tools that I feel are on the desk or in the room that I can turn to.
Yeah. It's funny, when I was getting ready for this interview, I read a lot of your poems aloud, just because I feel like you can live in a poem so much more fully if, well, at least I don't see meter on the page as well if I don't read it out loud.
That's right, yeah.
And that was so much fun.
Thank you.
I also really enjoyed that you included capoeira in this poem.
Yeah.
I think that the history of capoeira is so fascinating, and I'm trying to remember, I hope I don't get this wrong, but I think that It was a way for the slaves in Brazil to practice fighting skills when they weren't allowed to, and they dressed it up to look like entertainment.
That's right.
For observers, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. They made it look like a dance, and yet it was a form of martial arts that is still practiced to this day. The birimbau is the instrument that, it's a kind of percussion instrument, as I described, with the bow and string.
Right.
And a friend of mine, Jason Finkelman, was the first to kind of introduce me to the instrument. He's a musician in Urbana-Champaign now, but when we were young in Philadelphia, he played the capoeira, and I just loved the sound, and I loved the gourd and stone. There's a, while one hand is playing with the stick, beating the stick against the wire, it's also playing the instrument.
Okay, that again was part of a conversation with Major Jackson from earlier this year. Major Jackson was the winner of the 2016 Vermont Book Award for his poetry collection, Roll Deep. And he was also a judge for the 2015 award. Another judge that year was the poet Sidney Lee, who has also been on this show a number of times. Most recently, I interviewed him in June with the Vermont Poet Laureate, Chard de Njord. They worked together to edit a new collection called Roads Taken, Contemporary Vermont Poetry, which was published by the Vermont Press, Green Writers Press. D.D. Cummings is the publisher of that press. Sidney Lee was Poet Laureate of Vermont from 2011 to 2015. His most recent collection of poems, No Doubt the Nameless, is available from Four Way Books. I'm going to play a little bit of an interview with Sid, and then I'm going to jump ahead to the interview that I did with Chard. So you're going to get to hear from both of those gentlemen. Sidney Lee was a judge for the Vermont Book Award for the 2015 award, and Chard de Njord is actually on the panel of judges this year. So I hope you enjoy. Let's just jump in and see what Sid had to say for himself. This was so funny. He was on vacation he was staying out in the woods of Maine, and at one point he read something from the collection, and he told me he was sitting on a stump in the woods, and it was so perfect. It was so funny. Anyway, here we go. A little bit of an interview with Sidney Lee.
Much longer by way of seasonal residents like Robert Penn Warren, or you had to have been born in Vermont like Dan Chaffin or Norman Doobie, who don't usually get associated with Vermont, but were born, I think, in Windsor and Barry, respectively, or Bellows Falls and Barry, respectively. So we really never butted heads. We agreed virtually on the two of the five poems that each poet sent to us, ended up with a book that I think is really good, and it's not because of us, it's because of the quality of the poetry.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. Now, how did you acquire the poems? Did you request submissions, or did you go to the poets and say, we want your specific work?
No, we didn't ask for particular poems. We asked each of the poets on our list to send five poems from which we would pick two. The only people who have more than two poems are those, in all humility, like me and Chard and Louise Glick and Ellen Bryan Voigt and so on, who have been poets laureate, who get three. So we gave ourselves a little bit of a pat on the back in that respect. But no, there was no predetermination of which poems we wanted, except, of course, by way of those who had died by the time we got around to collecting material.
Yeah, I loved seeing work in the book by David Budbill and Leland Kinsey. I suppose I was a little surprised to find that Robert Frost, but then he's had such an influence on all the poets that live in Vermont.
Right. Well, we just sort of thought that we would define contemporary as beginning with Frost. That's perhaps a little bit of an expansion of the term, but what seemed like a logical place to start. In the cases of David and Lee, the poems were submitted before their, to me, very unfortunate deaths. They both seemed to be in fairly good shape when they sent the poems. David's, in a curious way, are a little bit prophetic of his demise, mm-hmm. Which is unsettling. But at all events, we managed to include them, and they knew they were included while they were still on the planet.
Yeah, yeah. So you identified the poets that you wanted to have in the collection. You didn't put out any sort of call for submissions or anything like that.
No, we didn't, although in some cases, you know, the trouble with an anthology like this is that you're gonna publish the darn thing, and you yourself will realize within a week of its publication, oh, God, why, how in the world did we overlook her, you know? And, in fact, that happened, you know, at the 10 minutes of 12 hour, and we got some in whom we had overlooked, strangely enough, stunningly strangely enough, a couple of them had been students of mine at Vermont College. So,
oh, no.
The more inexcusable. One advantage of this print-on-demand format is that you can quickly make revisions. There were some, in the first limited run, there were a number of typos, some format problems, and one or two admissions, including Reuben Jackson, who's a jazz DJ on PPR and has more than one book out, and we were able to include him in the imminent second edition. So it's too bad to have overlooked some people in the first instance. Fortunately, that's amendable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to jump in again and interrupt, but I want to play another part of that interview, which is with Char de Njord, who is our current poet laureate, who collaborated with Sid to edit that collection, Roads Taken. He was talking about that collection and not the Vermont Book Award when he talked about how they were choosing people to participate. The collection's called Roads Taken, Contemporary Vermont Poetry. Again, it was published by Green Writers Press. Before I play a little bit of the interview with Chard, I'll just mention that he is one of the judges this year, and he is, as I said, the Vermont Poet Laureate. He was born in Connecticut and raised in Lynchburg, Virginia, where he attended Lynchburg College. And he, let's see, I'm trying to fly through his bio here because we don't have a lot of time. But anyway, he has written a lot of poetry collections, including Interstate, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press, Speaking in Turn, a collaboration with Tony Sanders, Noman Press, The Double Truth, University of Pittsburgh Press, Night Mowing, University of Pittsburgh Press, and let's see, he's also, there's other poetry collections. He's also authored a book of essays and interviews with renowned poets called Sad Friends, and he's currently a professor of English at Providence College, and he's the poet laureate, as I said, of Vermont. He lives in Westminster West, Vermont, with his wife, Liz. So we'll just jump in now to a little bit of my conversation with Chard, which again was about that same collection, Roads Taken.
Working with the Youth Writers Project as much as I can. So these are just some things that I'm doing.
Yeah, okay.
I'm trying to write, just considering writing myself. That's really sort of at the top of my list. I don't say that selfishly, but if I'm not writing, I just am not a happy camper.
Yeah, and it must be really hard to have time to do everything, particularly now that this, you know, it's a wonderful honor, but it's probably quite time-consuming.
I teach full-time. I'm a professor of English and creative writing at Providence College.
Oh, wow.
I commute down there twice a week, go down and back the same day, so that I can be in Vermont as much as possible.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Vermont as the subject of this collection of poetry. You know, the editor's note at the beginning talks about its mystical landscape and fiercely self-reliant citizenry.
Yeah,
so
that was Yeah, go ahead.
No, I loved that. I thought that was a wonderful description. And I just wondered if there are any other aspects of the state's character that come to mind for you when you think about the poems that you received.
I think that sort of captures it for me.
Yeah.
You know, it's increasingly diverse. If there's one thing Vermont is lacking, of course, it's a diverse citizenry. Not of course that many black folks in Vermont, and that's something that other poets such as David Budbill has written a lot about.
Yeah.
So I am certainly mindful of that and wish to do all I can to be as inclusive and Catholic with a small C in my taste.
Right.
That description, though, you know, Vermont, of all the New England states, is perhaps sort of the most independent and fiercely self-reliant. I mean,
yes.
it's the last state to sort of hold out, to, you know, as a state in New England.
Yeah, the fact that we separated from the country at one point sort of represents
that's right. That's right. When they wanted Chittenden to be the president, really, of Vermont as the country. Of course, it failed back in the late 18th century. But
right.
There's... But, you know, Vermonters, the first Vermonters moved up from Massachusetts primarily and were, you know, just incredible in their work ethic and their ingenuity. They're more, I think, patents from Vermonters than any other state per capita for farm equipment and industrial equipment. The logging they did, 80% of Vermont was cleared at one point, was tillable for grazing land. So to be able to clear that much land, to build that many stone walls, and to live, really, the first Vermonters lived inside of trees they hollowed out, you know. They were almost animalistic in a way.
Wow. I don't think I know that history.
Yeah, and as far as its utopian communities, such newfound religions as a perfectionist that started in Putney, Vermont, and ended up in Oneida with John Humphrey Noyes. So it's always been a kind of religious laboratory as well as this fiercely independent state where people just lived by their wits and strength and some brute will that is almost unparalleled. And so that somehow has... really has come down into the poetry of Vermont, has filtered, you know, both culturally and physically in a way into the culture that has made it a unique state.
So that, again, was just a little snippet of a conversation with Char de Njord, our current poet laureate. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and you are listening to WBTV LP in Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org and broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. Today I'm doing a kind of a replay of a show that I did during Arts Hop, and it's in anticipation of the Vermont Book Award being awarded on Saturday. I'm playing little excerpts from lots of different interviews with people who are somehow involved in the Vermont Book Award. For example, Char de Njord is one of the judges this year for this year's award. We also heard from Sidney Lee. He was a judge in 2015. And so next we're going to hear an interview with the author Sean Prentice, who was a judge in 2015 and also a finalist in 2016 for his creative nonfiction book Finding Abby, which was this extraordinary book, Finding Abby, The Search for Edward Abbey and His Hidden Desert Grave, which was published by the University of New Mexico Press. And my friend and then co-host Gary Lee Miller, who's a short story writer that you heard from earlier, he interviewed Sean in June of 2015. And so we're going to just listen to a little bit of that interview in just a second here, and then we'll continue on. So... here we have a little conversation between Gary Lee Miller, who was a finalist in the 2015 Vermont Book Award, and Sean Prentice, who was a judge that year but also was a finalist in 2016 for the Vermont Book Award. I'm just going to jump in.
First off, these are iconic men. But also these are all big men. I think Ken Slide is the smallest. All the others are well over 6 feet and big, manly men. So, you know, if they don't like my project, if they don't trust me, you know, I've got to deal with, you know, men who are known to defend what they love, and they love Abby. And, you know, that could be a very interesting situation. So, you know, I thought of a couple things before going in. One is that I would, you know, only ask questions that I would feel comfortable answering. So I was not an expose, you know, journalist trying to dig up dirt. What I wanted to hear was about a man and about his story and about Abby's life with his friends. So I think as they heard my questions, they're pretty benign, and really what I'm trying to find out is the story of a man's life and just share that with readers, because I think Abby is a complicated, beautiful writer and human.
Yeah, were they easy to approach, or was there any tension there initially when you...
Three were very easy. So Jack Loeffler, I had a house from the book, H-A-U-S, got me in connection with Loeffler, so that was a very
easy... And that's your friend from college?
Yeah. He and I have been friends since we were teenagers, so we've been friends almost our whole lives. Ken Slite was relatively easy to connect with because I had another friend who knew his wife. David Peterson was very easy to connect with, but then Doug Peacock, who is the real-life George Washington Hayduke from the Monkey Wrench Gang, was much more difficult, and he was much more difficult because he thought I was doing a very different project. He thought I was writing a guidebook where I'd set out Karens and tell you how to get to Abby's grave.
Oh, right. So he wanted nothing to do with that.
Nothing
project.
To do with that. And I want nothing to do with that project. But once I articulated to him what I was trying to do, then he said, yeah, fly out to Arizona. I'll do an interview. And once I went out there, I mean, well, first off, we sit down and put the .357 Magnum between the two of us. And then he jokingly tells me about how his, you know, he and a friend were talking about, you know, bringing violence to me if I was writing a guidebook. But then after that, we spent 7 hours between the desert and his home just talking nonstop. He invited me back for dinner and ice cream. So what started out as a hard interview to get became 7 wonderful, wonderful hours.
What did you feel like when you pulled out a very large handgun? And
I guess I wasn't worried. I figured, I didn't think that any trouble was going to come. And even though he was, you know, talking about physical violence to me, I didn't feel any sense of real physical violence coming. It felt like a joke. And as a writer, I sure knew it'd be a great story. So I guess I trusted Doug. By that point, it was too late in the conversation for him to truly be, you know, threatening to kill me. And if he wants to kill me, he's a former Green Beret medic. I bet you he can. So I just figured, well, let's just have a good interview. And, you know, if he kills me out here and buries me somewhere, then, you know, hopefully my wife, Sarah, will finding Abby on my computer and get it published, and it'll be a really big deal. But no, I had a feeling that I'd be pretty darn safe.
So what you're saying is you'd rather go for staying alive and perhaps lower sales figures than having a huge hit and shot dead and buried in the desert?
Yep, but the second one offers some good benefits as well, I guess.
Yeah, a little fame.
Yep.
Can you just... I know you did. You mentioned earlier you did a ton of research for this, both in natural history, and I'm assuming a lot of research just about Edward Abbey himself. Can you tell me a little bit about what you learned from meeting his friends that you might not have been able to learn in a book?
Yeah. What I learned, a couple different things. One of the biggest things is you can learn a lot about a person by how loyal his friends are. And Abbey's friends, let's see, it's been, you know, 25 years later, 26 years later, are deeply loyal to his ideas and to who the man was. And if people are that loyal to someone, there's something great about that. They could have easily moved on. They could have easily forgotten about him. But their deep friendship, their deep love, and their deep loyalty was something that was really, really beautiful. And you just hear the stories they tell, and they're just one incredible, funny, crazy story upon another, but everyone is laced with this brotherly love that's just a really beautiful thing.
That was an excerpt from an interview with Sean Prentice, conducted by Gary Lee Miller, both of whom have had some involvement in the Vermont Book Award, which is what we're talking about today. So Sean Prentice had written the book Finding Abby, The Search for Edward Abbey and His Hidden Desert Grave. All of the interviews that you're hearing excerpts from today are available on the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. Right now, I'm just going to play a little bit of an excerpt. We did hear a full interview with Castle Freeman recently. I'm going to play a little bit of an excerpt from one of my I've done two interviews with Castle. He was a finalist in the 2016 Vermont Book Award for his novel Devil in the Valley. And so I'm going to play just a little bit of an interview with him. He has a very long bio on his website, but I will just say that he is a wonderful Vermont author, and he has a number of books that are both fiction and nonfiction. Some of them are, as I mentioned, The Devil in the Valley, Go With Me, All That I Have, Round Mountain, which is a story collection, My Life and Adventures, a novel, A Stitch in Time, Towns in Vermont, 1753 to 2003, Judgment Hill, Spring Snow, and The Bride of Ambrose, and other stories. So here's a little bit of a conversation that I had with Castle Freeman in 2016 about his novel, Devil in the Valley, which was published by Overlook Duckworth. So here you go, a little bit of an interview with Castle Freeman Jr. Of course, Carter and Taft and a lot of these names are Lincoln. But generally speaking, when you don't have that as your guiding principle, do you pick up phone books? Do you have, how do you source your names?
I've done phone books, yeah.
Yeah.
I just come up with ideas. I don't use the names of real people that I know.
No.
But phone books I have done, yes. Yeah. And, other comparable sources, advertising.
I remember my sister graduated from a graduate program at MIT, and I went to the ceremony, and they had this massive, thick book for the graduation ceremony because so many people were getting degrees that day. And I thought, oh, this will be a great character source, right? So I took the book home, and then I'm looking through it, and I'm like, well, unless I'm going to really be writing about a lot of people who are from other places. You know, these names were so extremely distinctive.
Exotic,
exactly. Okay, your books tend to be short, and I think this has to do with your economy of words. This book, I think, is less than 200 pages.
Yeah.
No words are ever wasted, ever. And I wondered if we could talk about this. Do you draft short and then revise short, or do you draft long and then revise? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I think I'm more likely to start short and then get a little bit longer.
Okay.
But I where the shortness comes from with me, I guess, is just that I was taught that that's good writing, is concise and brief. I have written one novel that was respectable in length. It's 400 and some pages.
Uh-huh.
My Life and Adventures. That was published 10 years ago.
Oh.
But since then, I've been under 200 pages. And this new one that I mentioned that hasn't got a publisher yet will be the same magnitude as this book.
Mm-hmm. Did it surprise you when the book came out at over 400, the other one?
Yeah. Because I'd written, that was my second novel, and the first one was more shorty, like these, although not as. But yeah, I was kind of stunned. God.
And it didn't feel like it was a mistake. It just didn't feel finished yet.
Oh, good. That's a very kind of diverse novel. It includes all kinds of non-novelistic, ostensible facts and tables. It even has tables and lists and stuff. So it should have been long was appropriate, I thought, if only because of its diversity.
Yeah. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about absurdity. And this, I think, it's related to your humor. But there's absurdity in this book. And I think in the other book that I interviewed you about, which was... What was the other book that I interviewed?
Go With Me?
I think it was Go With Me.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah.
Is that the one with the
kitchen scene on the cover with the man and woman?
No, that's All That I Have.
All that I think that's what it was then.
Yeah.
All That I Have. Same characters, though, right?
Yes.
Go With Me.
No. The same characters in All That I Have are in this new book, new novel that I've written.
Oh, but that was the first?
Working on. Go With Me is a different set of characters.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you mind if I read one more thing again?
Of course not.
Okay. Let's see. That's one thing I miss about this place is my dogs. Do you remember any of my dogs? I think that's Calpurnia talking.
Yep.
I remember your cat. I remember Snowflake. That's Eli, another character.
Yep.
Then Calpurnia says, Snowflake was a rabbit. He was Ruthie's rabbit. That was later. The cat was Snowball, but she wasn't mine. She lived in the barn. Before my time, says Eli. Long before, says Calpurnia. No, I never wanted a cat. Cats make me feel bad. Anyway, the sort of like the back and forth, and it's like, do you remember my dogs? I remember your cat. Snowflake. Yeah. No, Snowflake was a rabbit. He was Ruthie's rabbit. That was later. The cat was Snowbell, but she wasn't mine. You know, it's sort of like a who's on first kind of absurdity that's very fun.
But it's also, there's a certain realism to it. It's also, and that's how people do. They sit around. They're not really talking about anything particularly important, but they bat it back and forth and they knock it around and they make fun of each other and they have a fine time.
Yeah.
And that's the idea.
It is. It's fun. Okay. This sentence jumped out at me as I was reading the book, and I just had a feeling it was meant to be a very important sentence. You can correct me if I'm wrong. You beat the devil not by superior play, but by ignoring the game.
Oh yeah, that's an important line and an important idea to me, and Dangerfield then later calls him on that, and says this is not going to work.
Yeah, yeah.
we have a deal, and the fact that you decided you didn't like it, that's not going to make much difference.
Right. Yeah, I just felt like that was such a great line, and actually, what came to my mind, you mentioned Trump before. You know, his Twitter account and how people would try to out-tweet him. The absurdity of this is ridiculous. But anyway, people would try to out-tweet him. And I thought, you know, you beat that by not by superior play, but by ignoring the game. I mean, I think okay, that seemed like a good place to stop. That was a snippet of an interview with Castle Freeman Jr., about his wonderful novel, The Devil in the Valley, published by Overlook Duckworth. Came out the same time I spoke with him, December of 2016. And Castle and that book were finalists for the 2016 Book Award. Another finalist for the 2016 Book Award was the wonderful author David Huddle. He was actually the very first guest that I had on this show. And I'm going to just play a little bit of a snippet of an interview with him. David Huddle is from Ivanhoe, Virginia. He's lived in Vermont for 44 years. He's taught at the University of Vermont, Hollins University, Middlebury College, Goddard College, Johnson State College, Radford University, Austin Peay State University, the University of Idaho, the Breadloaf School of English, more and more. It goes on. His fiction, poetry, and essays have appeared in The American Scholar, Esquire, Appalachian Heritage, The New Yorker, Harper's Poetry, Story, Shenandoah, Agni, and that goes on and on, too. He's written a number of novels and poetry collections. His novel, The Fox Chronicle, appeared from Tupelo Press in fall 2014. His novel, Kira's List, was Tupelo Press in spring of 16, and then he had a paperback come out in 2016 later, My Immaculate Assassin, and that was published, let's see here, by Tupelo Press. And so this is just a snippet of an interview with poet and author David Huddle from 2008, March of 2008, which is the very first episode of this show. We're just going to jump in and see what we were talking about, like at around minute 21.
When they buy a book, much of what they're looking for is a book that's all finished and all that they just need to send it to the proofreader and it's all done. But that was not the case at Houghton Mifflin. Both Heidi Pittler, who was sort of my immediate editor, and then Janet Silver, who's sort of the boss of the trade division of Houghton Mifflin, both of them had a lot of say about, and they had no hesitation about going in and doing sentence by sentence work, and also by just sort of saying, no, this chapter won't work and this chapter won't work, and you need to do something else. So, which caused me great pain. I, you know, often spend a lot of time just walking around the house in a pout, kind of talking to myself and calling them names and all sorts of things before I got reconciled to the to taking their suggestions and doing the work on them. But I should also say that at smaller houses, I've had excellent editorial responses. Help, that was true at David Godin with a couple of the editors that I had there. I had three different editors for my three books at David Godin. At several university presses, I've had no help whatsoever. And I really prefer having editorial comment and suggestions. That's a better thing for me.
Okay. You wrote in one of your essays, you wrote, training and luck, a part of which is that I've never made a lot of money with my own writing, have allowed me to give this very personal activity a more and more important place in my daily life. I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about how are writers lucky when they don't necessarily make a lot of money. So many writers, that's their big dream, and it is an yeah. elusive one.
Yes, yeah. Well, I was relieved to learn from reading Colm Tóibín's novel about Henry James, a book called The Master, that Henry James came from a very wealthy family and probably never had to work a day in his life. And we think of him as a, you know, great master of literature. And I think that probably had the freedom to write as he wished. I think he did make some money with his work, but probably not at first at all. Again, I think of Chris Bojadian, who's a very good writer, but it would make me so anxious. I would worry so much about whether I was writing well enough to make enough money out of my book to live on that I think it would really poison my writing. So with my books and even with my way of writing a book, doing it in pieces and kind of assembling different pieces that are in different points of view and different time frames, all that sort of thing is a very inefficient way to work, and it's one that... in which there's no real practical way to go about it. You just sort of have to do it the way a music composer does it, of sort of saying, well, this would go with that. So.
That was part of a conversation with David Huddle, Vermont author and poet. David Huddle, who was nominated for the Vermont Book Award in 2016. It's funny, that little snippet that I just played was the same one that I happened to jump on in during the Arts Hot show, so that's funny. Anyway, he was nominated for a collection called Dream Sender in 2016. The next snippet of interview that I'm going to play is with the Vermont author Jennifer McMahon, who was nominated in 2016 for the Vermont Book Award for her novel, The Night Sister. Jennifer McMahon was born in 1968, grew up in her grandmother's house in suburban Connecticut, where she was convinced a ghost named Virgil lived in the attic. She says, I wrote my first short story in third grade. I graduated with a BA from Goddard College in 1991 and then studied poetry for a year in the MFA and writing program at Vermont College. A poem turned into a story, which turned into a novel. Long story short, she became a novelist. So she has written a number of novels, including The One I Left Behind, Dismantled, Island of Lost Girls, Don't Breathe a Word, Promise Not to Tell, and the one she was nominated for, The Night Sister. I think her latest is called Burn Town, and that is published by, let's see, Doubleday. So anyway, I spoke to Jennifer McMahon in 2014 about her novel, The Winter People, which was also published by Doubleday. And I'm going to just jump in here and play a little of that conversation for you. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Today we're doing a second hour that has to do with the Vermont Book Award. You are listening to WBTV LP Burlington on 99.3 FM and streaming at 99.3 WBTV.org. The black flies found us when we were past the Devil's Hand, swarming in tiny little clouds. Toadstools sprouted here and there, inky and poisonous. The path bent and turned, moving downhill. So I'll stop there, and I don't want to talk about what the plot's about to do, but I do want to talk about what that paragraph does, mm-hmm. which I just, that really stood out to me. And actually, the very beginning of the book has a similar paragraph that you read earlier about the flora of where she is playing near the Devil's Hand, and it's very different.
It is very different.
But those details kind of herald important moments. So anyway, if you can just talk mm-hmm. about
yeah,
your
I
use
mean,
of detail
I,
there.
I think that I'm sort of turning the forest and the setting into something a little darker and spookier than in the early chapter where she's there with the, you know, the trout lilies and the jack in the pulpits.
Where she's still innocent.
Where she's still innocent, yeah. And here she's been through a lot and something terrible has happened and is about to happen.
Right.
And even the brightest, most wonderful landscape can look pretty bleak when you're under an emotional weight.
Right.
You know, you're going to notice things like, not things like the pretty flowers, but like the toadstools and the fact that the fruit is misshapen and spotted with blight and everything is sort of ruined.
And that's it, isn't it? It's what you notice in a certain state of
it
mind.
It is. Absolutely. Yeah. That's
now, is that the kind of thing that you would have been likely to write in revision, like after you've put everything on the dining room floor, or is that something that you...
I honestly can't remember. That might, you know, bits and pieces of it might have come in the very first thing, but that's something, you know, all those details, the layering of the details are things that I would really work on in revision, when I'm going through it with my senses and trying to really, you know, make everything as atmospheric as possible, whatever that means to each.
That was a snippet of a conversation with Jennifer McMahon, who was nominated for the Vermont Book Award in 2016. When I did this show during Arts Hop, I didn't get to everybody. One interview that I want to get to today is with Angela Palm. She's the author of Riverine, or Riverine, you can say it either way, a memoir from Anywhere But Here, which was published by Grey Wolf Press, and she is actually a finalist for this year's competition, the Vermont Book Award. She's the only one of the finalists for this year's award that I've actually interviewed. So I would like to just do a little tiny bit of my interview with Angie from 2016. We did talk about Riverine, which received the 2014 Grey Wolf Press Nonfiction Prize. She has, let me just tell you a little bit about Angie. We're running low on time, so I'm going to make it quick. Angela Palm is an author, editor, and writing instructor. Her first book, Riverine, a memoir from Anywhere But Here, was released in August 2016 from Grey Wolf Press. It has been selected as a finalist for both the Vermont Book Award and as the emerging author finalist for the 2017 Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award. The book has been very highly reviewed. It, again, also was mentioned in Oprah Magazine. Wonderful reviews from Publishers Weekly, Kirkus. Angie's published a lot of stories and flash fiction and all kinds. And she also edited a collection a number of years ago that was based, it was called Please Do Not Remove. It was published by Windridge Books, and it was a collection of work by Vermont writers that was inspired by Vermont library cards, which was pretty cool. So anyway, here is just a little bit of an interview with Angela Palm from 2016.
Works. Mm-hmm. And so usually what will happen is I'll have some experience where I'll read something or I'll watch a film or see, you know, a painting that to me informs the story that I'm already telling and kind of completes it in some way that I didn't see coming. And that part's really exciting for me because I think that it reflects the way that we think. You know, when we read a book, we think about how is this like me or different than me? How do I associate this, you know, with my experiences or sort of bring my experience to this work mm-hmm. or what I already knew of this work? And I think that that's why I do that, and that's how it sort of comes together in this way. Is like how is everything interrelated,
right?
Or how can it be? And for me, it just is like a richer experience on the writing end of it,
right?
And I don't know if it's a richer experience for the reader or not, but it's what I enjoy doing. And I kind of even, like, create this challenge for myself to, like, bring a number of things to the table in an essay that on their face, like, if you just mention them as, like, a list, don't seem like they should inform each other at all.
Right.
And the challenge for me is to write it in a way that without any piece of that, the whole thing would fall apart.
So what might that look like? Like, do you say, okay, I'm going to make music a part of this? Or do you say, I'm going to make the Beatles a part of this? Or do you say, I'm going to make back in the USSR a part of this? Do you know what I mean? Like, how specific are you about what you have to involve?
You know, it's definitely not like a specific goal from the outside. It's just like if something like starts to kind of speak to me as I'm writing it, then it will become a part of it. For example, I was I'd watched Badlands and was talking about Badlands, the Terrence Malick film, with a friend as I was writing this essay about going back to the prison, and I started to see parallels between this bad girl bad boy relationship and the murder and things like that, and I started comparing them and trying to understand like, how is this different than what this almost stereotypical story is?
That was a snippet of a conversation with Angela Palm from 2016. Her book, Riverine, A Memoir from Anywhere But Here, was published by Grey Wolf Press in 2016. It won the 2014 Grey Wolf Press Nonfiction Prize, and it has been nominated for the Vermont Book Award, which is going to be awarded to somebody this Saturday. And that's what our show today has been about. People I've interviewed who have something to do with the Vermont Book Award. We did not get to one of the people who's a judge this year, and that's Tanya Lee Stone, and I'm sad about that. But anyway, I'm going to try to talk to her later this year or early next year, so you'll get to hear a conversation with her. But there is a conversation archived on the podcast site with Tanya Lee Stone, and you should definitely go check it out if you have time to do that at some point. It's writethebook.podbean.com. You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. This has been Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. Have a great week.